Today on Vox Talks Economics, how to manufacture vaccines during the next pandemic. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics, the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week, we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember, subscribe. Follow us on Instagram as well. Now, a couple of years ago, you may remember, we did many, many podcasts on how to create and distribute COVID vaccines. So, as with fear and trepidation, we await the next global pandemic. What have we learned from how policy worked or didn't work 3 years ago? How can countries cooperate to create a responsive and a resilient vaccine supply chain if history were to repeat itself? Chad Bown of the Peterson Institute, a longtime friend of Vox Talks Economics, and also the host of Trade Talks, the only other podcast we recommend around here, has written a paper about this, and he joins me now. Chad, welcome back to Vox Talks Economics.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
When we were faced in early 2020 with having to make billions of doses of vaccine, we had to develop it, manufacture it, distribute it, administer it. It hadn't been done before, at least at this scale. But could policymakers call on good research? Did we know basically how to do it?
Maybe, but if they did, or if there was some obvious playbook out there of what to do, I certainly wasn't able to find it. And I was no expert on this stuff heading in. So what I did is I looked around, and the closest thing that we had was probably the work by Michael Kramer, who was the Nobel Prize-winning economics laureate. He had done all this work on vaccines to tackle the problem of infectious diseases in poor countries and what the economic disincentives were there and how to creatively address that kind of public health problem. And he and a number of other experts from that world came together very quickly over the early days and months of the pandemic to put together some proposals drawing from that work. But I fear that there really wasn't anything off the shelf at that moment in time, despite their best efforts. And I think that's actually, you know, reflective of the policy that we ended up with.
Yes. And what we're going to be talking about today is how to not fall into all these traps, market failure problems that we have when creating billions of doses of vaccine. Some people might think, well, there's almost inexhaustible demand and there's a lot of money going around, people being prepared to pay for all these doses. Why is there a market failure that might require incentives or subsidies when we're producing vaccines?
Well, there's a couple of market failures. Yeah. There's one, obviously, on the demand side. So what people like you and me would face. People, despite, you know, it being a pandemic, don't take into consideration the fact that if I take one of these vaccines, that not only benefits me, but it actually also benefits society as well. I'm less likely to perhaps transmit the disease to other people, to really get sick and strain the hospital system and things like that. So to address that problem, what typically happens is governments step in. They don't leave it to just people like you and me to go out and buy vaccines. The United States government, for example, bought the vaccines and then essentially gave them out to consumers, to people like me, for free.
Yeah.
So we don't have to pay anything at all. But that then really centralizes who it is that's going to be buying these things at the end of the day into governments. So that's sort of how that was tackled. But then on the supply side, the production side of vaccines, there's other problems as well. And one that we had learned from, again, the work of Michael Kramer and the infectious disease experts was essentially that the private sector doesn't really face the right incentives. And part of the problem is coming up with any vaccine is super duper expensive. There's a lot of research and development costs, fancy scientists, labs to just kind of come up with the vaccine in the first place. It can cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And then you need to send these things through clinical trials and test them on 30, 40, 50, 60,000 people all at once, track data on those people over time, keep data on them to make sure that you know if it's working, if it's not working. So there's a lot of upfront costs before you even know whether a vaccine works. And companies don't want to pay that because even if they discover a vaccine in the first place and find one that works, the government, the buyer, then would come to them and say, well, that's great that you have one. We're willing to now pay you for producing it and only producing it. And so firms recognize that, gosh, if we sink all those resources into coming up with the vaccine in the first place, ultimately, at the end of the day, the government is only going to pay us to produce the thing. And this is what's called the standard holdup problem in economics.
Yeah.
And so firms don't bother to do all that investments, and we get too little investment in vaccines generally. So that's why there is a role for government policymakers to step in and try to come up with creative ways to overcome these kinds of market failures.
I was looking at some of the government communications from the very early days of the pandemic, when it first became obvious that we would have to put in this huge effort to find vaccines. And at that time, they were predicting it might take several years, you know, that we'd only be getting it now because of all these huge problems. When we're faced with something like COVID that was entirely new in its scale, is that market failure worse?
Absolutely. So in any given year, when we think about a product like vaccines, if you have kids, when your kids are born, you've got to inoculate them with various vaccines every couple of months. Well, you know, even if you add up all the kids being born around the world at the same time, there's only maybe, you know, a couple hundred million new babies that show up in any given year.
Yeah.
That's not all that many vaccines that you need. For the pandemic, everybody needed a vaccine and needed it at the same time. So demand was, instead of being maybe 100 million doses, it was 8 billion people, 16 billion doses of this thing suddenly at the same time. So the scale of the demand was huge. But then the second big problem was we really needed speed. And that's because people were dying, right? Unlike maybe you can wait for a couple of months to get an MMR, a, you know, children's vaccine of something. This is, we needed to get people vaccines as quickly as possible or they might die. And economies were being locked down. And there was huge, huge economic costs by economies not being able to function. So the two key elements, what made the pandemic really different for vaccines, is immense scale, the number of doses you needed and how quickly you wanted to have them delivered.
In your paper, you divide these incentives into providing what you've called a push and a pull into how to get these vaccines to market. Now, first of all, the push is to make it attractive for pharma companies to develop the vaccines in the first place. Is that correct?
Yes. You know, they don't know when they're starting their research, their clinical trials, if this thing is going to actually work or not.
Mm.
So one thing that governments can do, and this is what the experts in this area call push types of subsidies or push types of contracts, is the government can just say, here's funding to cover your R&D costs. Or, and critically, this is going to be important in the case of COVID, once you get a potentially viable vaccine candidate, and you're at the stage, if it's made it through the first couple of stages of clinical trials, and now we're right at the last stage, the one where we give it to 30,000 people at once and really make sure that this thing works and understand the side effects, that typically, that process takes 4, 5, 6 months to play it out once you work it all the way through. Well, what we can be doing at the same time that clinical trial process is playing out is the government can be subsidizing the companies so that they build their production facilities and build out their supply chains, contact all their input suppliers and everything, so that if the vaccine actually does pass the clinical trial, it's ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got production that's at scale, up and running almost immediately. And the reason why you need a push contract is otherwise the companies don't have any incentive to make those investments, because there's a really good chance all these vaccines might not work. And at the end of the day, many of them did not work. So they don't want to sink all those costs if their vaccine isn't going to work unless they're subsidized to do so. So yes, push contracts, push subsidies was one form of trying to incentivize speed in that process.
And we forget now just how risky this R&D was for those companies that were undertaking it, because they hadn't done anything quite like this before. This really shows how government money provided in that way can de-risk something that is an extraordinarily risky bet.
I remember the World Health Organization was keeping tabs on how many vaccine candidates were in various stages of clinical trials around the world. And there were hundreds, hundreds, right? But at the end of the day, you know, there were really 4, 5, 6, 7 that ultimately passed clinical trials and ended up being deployed in any great number. So from out of 200, 300, we ended up with 6 or 7. Really small odds, right, that any one of those vaccines was actually going to work out when we were first starting this process back in early 2020.
Right. So providing that R&D subsidy is the push, gets us to the first dose of the vaccine. What's the pull?
So the pull is another way the governments can try to incentivize speed. And so one thing they can do is to write contracts that say, hey, if you get doses delivered by this early date, you get an extra bonus payment kind of thing. Trying to encourage them to recognize the need for speed and do things that might not otherwise be doing if the private firms were just thinking about their normal risk management, cost-benefit analysis, but actually taking into consideration the need that society had for speed.
You make this point quite clearly in the paper, and it's something I hadn't really thought about. There's a big difference between contracting to buy, I don't know, 1 billion doses of a vaccine and contracting to buy 1 billion doses of a vaccine delivered by the 31st of July, for example. What's the difference here in how the incentive works?
This really did come up. And again, we had never gone through this before.
No.
But when you write one of these contracts, what are you doing? If I'm a government and I'm signing a contract with one of these vaccine manufacturers for a billion, 100 million doses, whatever it is, am I just being allocated a place in their queue, in the line, and I'll get it when I get it? Or maybe I give them a lot of money and I get a place earlier in the line. And well, if that happens, then all I'm doing is displacing somebody else.
Yeah.
I'm imposing a negative externality cost on some other country that's now been pushed later in the line. Whereas if I write a contract with a vaccine manufacturer that is written in a way that they build additional capacity. So they build, you know, a 100 million dose facility for me, and that's part of the contract. Well, that's great because not only does that help me, but that then is capacity that can be used by someone else once my order has been fulfilled. That creates sort of a positive externality benefits for everybody else in the world that is also going to need these vaccines.
I remember that national angst about where we were in the queue. Are they getting it before us? Who are they going to deliver it to first? There is also the problem, isn't there, that we're talking about the production of vaccines as if it all happens in one building or, well, at least in one country. Research, the trials, the sourcing of the inputs, the manufacturing and distribution. For a long time now, this has been offshored and outsourced, hasn't it? And it happens all over the place just to produce one vaccine. Now, does this mean that those incentives are less effective or don't work?
It could. And that's, I think, what we have to try to figure out.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. I mean, what was amazing that we learned about vaccine manufacturing during the pandemic was we think about big pharma. So we heard names like Pfizer or AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson, these global giant pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
But almost none of them did all of their production in-house, in their own facilities, in one country. Pfizer was the closest example of just doing all of that. Most of them contracted out the work to other companies and had a very fragmented production process, a supply chain. And oftentimes that was done in other countries as well, gathering inputs, having production facilities all around the world. And you can imagine the challenges for policymakers then. So what the policymaker is trying to do is to convince the vaccine manufacturer to scale up its production facility to produce as many doses as they possibly can, as quickly as they possibly can to save lives. Well, those manufacturing facilities, they need inputs. Can they send the right signals to all the input providers so that the input providers that are making bioreactor bags or syringes or all of the little things that need to go into a vaccine, to have them scale up their production capacity as well? Because if they didn't, if you don't have enough inputs, you're not going to have enough output. And I think that was what we ran into. We ran into input shortages throughout the pandemic, and we're still trying to, I think, diagnose some of why those things actually happened so that we can see if we can do better the next time around. But clearly, this was a big issue during the pandemic.
Yeah, it's a massively complex problem, I would imagine, because those pull incentives are being provided from many governments in many countries to many different pharma companies all exactly at the same time with a limited supply for them.
Exactly right. And there's just a small number of these firms,
yeah,
right? In economics, we're used to thinking about markets where there's hundreds or millions of firms all running around. There's not a lot of pharmaceutical companies, and there's not a lot of these input providers. And what the input providers were facing was huge demand for their stuff all coming at the same time with unclear price signals, their own sort of capacity constraints, and that ultimately resulted in a number of challenges.
Well, that's the theory, Chad. So let's have a look in a moment at what actually happened.
In September 2021, we asked how many lives would be saved if rich countries would share their COVID vaccines, and how many would be lost because it wasn't happening. Listen to the episode titled Share Vaccines, Save Lives.
Okay, Chad. So first of all, you analysed the US policy performance. It's, what was it? Operation Warp Speed, was it? How effective was their push?
I think out of all the countries in the world, probably the United States had the most effective subsidy policy in terms of vaccine manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And I think the argument for that is essentially the following. The first and probably most important thing was there was big diversification. So we talked about how there were a couple hundred candidates at the beginning. The U.S. didn't subsidize all of those, of course, but at least they subsidized six or seven. Mm-hmm. And some of those didn't work out. And that's sort of normal in this area. We expected many of them not to work out, but a couple did work out. And the fact that they had some that worked out and some that did not was okay. Diversification paid off. The second was they subsidized relatively early, meaning they got money out to these companies to help them get through their phase three trials. And that was beneficial because that meant that regulators around the world and other countries wouldn't necessarily, if they didn't want to, send vaccines through trials elsewhere. They could just rely on the US results if they trusted the Food and Drug Administration's assessment of the data. And I think that was important. The government helped to fund that. And then third, that the US government gave out contracts and subsidies to a number of these vaccine manufacturers to get them to set up their production facilities before the resolution of these phase three trials. And what that meant was when Pfizer and Moderna were granted authorization early in December of 2020, their production facilities were already up and running and they could begin to deliver tens of millions of doses immediately. And I think that was a hugely important benefit of the US program because, again, hundreds of thousands of lives were being lost, trillions of dollars of economic activity was being lost, and you just wanted not only huge volume of these vaccines, but also speed.
And the pull?
The pull is interesting. The pull requires a bit more knowledge of the actual contracts that these vaccine manufacturers signed, and we don't have all the details of those. They're largely redacted. But of the public versions that we have seen, Moderna, for example, we know was given an additional $3 per dose, provided they could meet a deadline for getting their vaccine through trials and getting doses delivered by something like end of January of 2021. So the evidence is at least consistent with the pull incentives working, at least in that one instance.
There's a reckoning coming on how governments performed in their COVID policies. There's going to be a COVID inquiry in the UK here and all over the world that's going to happen. You mentioned that not all of those bets that the US government placed on producing vaccines worked out. So is there an argument that I'm sure is going to be made that the US government overpaid in its subsidies?
I think the rational argument would be absolutely not. If anything, we underpaid for the level of economic harm that was saved mm-hmm. by getting access to the hundreds of millions of vaccines that worked as quickly as we did, that didn't actually cost all that much in relative terms. So I would say absolutely not. But sure, it was absolutely the case that the United States government ended up paying for some vaccines that it didn't ultimately use and that some that didn't ultimately work. But I see that as more of a insurance, yeah. right? That was its diversification. It's sort of like having a portfolio of stocks
yeah.
and financial markets. Some of them work, some of them don't. And the ones that really, really work, I mean, you didn't know who those were going to be ahead of time. And so you bought multiple stocks. Hmm. But at the end of the day, you're better off and you're sort of willing to take the losses that you ended up taking for the ones that didn't perform as well.
As you say, the US seems to have been conspicuously successful at this. You compared its performance to the EU and also to India. Did they not do as well?
The way I would characterize it is these different places, the US, Europe, and India, did some things well and did some things poorly. So the United States did great on the vaccine manufacturing side, did extremely poor on the vaccine sharing side, mm-hmm. right? Did not want to share, did not want to export doses to the rest of the world. That was a very, very bad policy. Europe was the opposite. Europe did great at sharing, allowing firms that were producing in Europe to be able to export to the world for the most part. What the European Union didn't do as well on was getting access to early doses. And that was because they didn't have as aggressive these sorts of push or pull contracts, mm-hmm. advanced market commitments to try to incentivize the companies to build out their supply chains early, right? Once it was clear which vaccines were going to work, then the companies made the investments. They were able to manufacture lots and lots of doses. It just took long. right? And this is some of the fights that we saw break out in Europe when they were seeing the UK or the United States get access to earlier doses than they did. This is why. The UK actually is one of the few other countries that did make investments early. The challenge the UK ran into is it was a smaller country than the United States, bet on a smaller portfolio of vaccine candidates, and many of those didn't ultimately work out. India is a completely different story. India historically is a massive manufacturer of vaccines and ultimately ended up being a very large producer of vaccines during the pandemic. It has some very, very important companies in this space. The challenge was the Indian government did not subsidize the Indian companies early enough. Mm-hmm. And so some of those companies came up with either their own resources, this is the Serum Institute, to build out some capacity before they knew whether or not their vaccines were going to be working or not. And they got some funding from NGOs, so CEPI and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So they were able to build out some capacity relatively early, earlier than they would have if they just relied on their own money. The challenge was the Indian government didn't help them until well into the pandemic when India had a major wave of cases. And when that happened, finally the Indian government offered some subsidies. It was quite late. And then the Indian government imposed export restrictions and said, you can't export these doses that had been being purchased by COVAX, effectively the multilateral community that was going to distribute these vaccine doses to developing countries all around the world. The Indian government said, no more. We need them here at home. That was arguably a very unfortunate set of events, what ended up happening in India.
The struggles of COVAX to get the doses, not only that it needed, but that it had been promised, sort of shows that there was a lot of economic nationalism about the policies as they were made here. Is policy when it comes to purchasing and supplying and distributing a vaccine that's urgently needed, is it always going to be a zero-sum game between countries?
You would hope not, but we saw very little evidence from the COVID-19 pandemic that that isn't the case. Again, of all of the major producing economies, Europe did relatively okay at allowing exports to happen. The challenge was it was just who had contracted with the vaccine companies at what prices. They weren't necessarily being distributed to deal with the global public health concerns, right? And allocated the places where the global public health experts might have said, these are the people that should get them first. These are the geographic locations that should get them first. There should be more equitable sharing around the world. That wasn't guiding the distribution side of things, unfortunately.
So there's one organization that we should mention, the World Trade Organization. If some of the flaws in the way that vaccine procurement, vaccine manufacturing is done are based on nationalism and the way that that works, could the WTO have a role if this recurs, if this problem needs solving a second time?
I think it absolutely could and should. And that's because the types of markets that are at stake here are these, you know, cross-border supply chains that are right in the WTO's wheelhouse in terms of, you know, it is the global international organization that knows the most about these things. The type of international policy coordination that would need to take place, probably the WTO is best positioned to facilitate, given that it has experts, trade ministers engaged on these types of issues. So the arguments for how the WTO would engage on this would be completely novel. Mm-hmm. It didn't do so during this pandemic, but I do think the WTO would be the best positioned international organization to help facilitate the kinds of international policy cooperation that we would need to have to be able to maximize the global supply as quickly as possible of vaccines in this sort of public health emergency.
Well, why didn't we hear very much from it during the last pandemic?
I would say there's probably three reasons. One, the WTO members didn't ask it to do it, right? And the WTO is a member-driven organization. It really relies on the governments to step forward and say, we want you to be the point entity to engage on this issue. We have to remember, as positive as I was about the U.S. manufacturing policy and Operation Warp Speed and what it did domestically, this was during the Trump administration, where they were doing everything they could to, you know, disengage from the WTO. And as one of the historical leaders in the multilateral trading system, not having in a very important country at all engaging, I think, played an important role. But second, the WTO historically has been a place, when it comes to things like subsidies, And again, what I'm talking about here is the novel forms of subsidies and contracting between governments and private companies to get them to expand production as quickly as possible into greater scale than they would otherwise. That's not typically what the WTO has been engaged on when it comes to the question of subsidies. Where policymakers get together at the WTO to talk about subsidies, it's all about how we should be constraining our subsidies. Mm. Now, I do think there are good public health and economic reasons in an instance like this to move in the other direction, to say, how do we coordinate the expansion of subsidies? But it would be quite different from how the WTO has handled subsidies historically. And then thirdly and lastly, you know, the other important thing that was going on at the WTO during this moment in time was a leadership transition. One director general was outgoing and made this announcement unexpectedly in the middle of 2020. And it took the WTO members a long time to coalesce around a new director general. And in fact, again, this was the United States holding up the process. So the new DG, Dr. Ngozi, didn't ultimately get into office until February or March of 2021, long after all of these critical supply chain decisions and government national subsidies, all that stuff had already been worked out. And so by the time she got into office, she was quite keen to engage the WTO in productive possible ways. But by then, for a lot of these critical issues, it was too late.
What could Dr. Ngozi put in place so that the next time this problem comes up, the WTO can play a more active role?
I think the first thing to do is to go back and analytically really assess what worked and what didn't work this time around and see what lessons national governments can learn and what then spills over into the WTO's traditional space of thinking about international policy coordination, things like subsidies, supply chains. And again, there was novel forms of international organization engagement on a lot of these issues. So we did have supply chain disruptions. We had input shortages. You had this organization, CEPI, that's a NGO out of Norway, stepped in, tried to help diagnose where the shortages were coming in, developed a secondhand market where vaccine equipment that manufacturers might need, a company sets up a production facility, buys all this equipment, but then it turns out their phase 3 trial didn't work. You didn't really need all that equipment, but they've got all this equipment now. Maybe some other company whose vaccine is going to work, but couldn't access all the equipment, maybe they need it. Yeah. Well, they set up a secondary market to facilitate those kinds of transactions. That's not their normal line of business, but it is something that WTO could be engaged in because it is the kind of thing that the WTO could be knowledgeable about. So in any case, the broad idea is the WTO, I think, would be the natural place since it's international commerce, since it's supply chains, since it's government policies to bring all this kind of thing together, learn from the past and apply it to future public health emergencies as well.
But Chad, it's not 20 years ago, given that the WTO seems to be having enormous struggles at taking care of its traditional business at the moment. Is it very likely that it will be able to step up?
I don't think it's likely. I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm an optimist, and so I'm forever hopeful. I agree. We've got challenges out there. We've got war, Russia, Ukraine, and the challenges there. We've got geopolitical conflict and tensions, the U.S. and China. This is global public health. Mm-hmm. This is a global public good. If there's one area where countries should be able to get past their differences because we live on one planet and we share one, health world, this arguably would be one of the places where they would want to do it. They should do it, and I'm hopeful that they might recognize that there is the opportunity to do it.
Reading this paper and looking back, it does make you a little bit optimistic because you remember how much there was to be done and how hopeless the picture looked in 2020 and how much we did achieve, even if we didn't get everything right. Chad, fascinating talking to you about it. I have a feeling we might be talking about this again, but for now, thank you very much.
Hopefully not, but thanks much, Tim. It's been great.
The paper is called The WTO and Vaccine Supply Chain Resilience During a Pandemic, and the author is Chad P. Bown. What does the P stand for? It stands for pretty good at talking about these sort of things. It is discussion paper 17876 at CEPR. It's also, I think, Chad, am I correct, going to be published in the Journal of International Economic Law?
That's right.
You can also find it there.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the best new research in economics every week. So subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, why not leave a review? Next time on Vox Talks, Hobbesian wars and the separation of powers.